Well, another winter is almost over, and March, true to form, has come in like a lion, and hopefully will go out like a lamb. At least that's how March works here in the United States. But did you know that March behaves differently in other countries? Norway, for example, March comes in like a polar bear and goes out like a walrus. Or take the case of Honduras, where March comes in like a lamb and goes out like a salt marsh harvest mouse. Let us compare this to the Maldive Islands, where March comes in like a wildebeest and goes out like an ant. A tiny little ant about this big. And there's a country where March hops in like a kangaroo and stays a kangaroo for a while, and then it becomes a slightly smaller kangaroo. Then for a couple days, it's sort of a cross between a frilled lizard and a common house cat. Wait. Then it changes back into a smaller kangaroo, and then it goes out like a wild dingo. Now, it's not Australia.
Hello and welcome to episode 12, the In Like a Lion edition of Notes from the Isle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. John Belushi, I am sure, did not know anything about Chautauqua County, but around here it's been my experience that March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lion. For me, it's a particularly nasty month, as by now the charm of winter has all but disappeared, leaving nothing in its wake but mud, grime, and road salt. Not quite winter, but not yet spring. It's a month that doesn't quite seem to live up to its promise, as astronomically speaking, spring will arrive in the middle of the month, but anything approaching spring-like weather still has a ways to go. Taking in some events at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House is a good way to pass the time awaiting spring's eventual arrival, and in this episode we're going to feature three events at the Opera House that will get us through that final push and the last few snowfalls. The first event is a new wrinkle in the Opera House's programming. Dr. Eliran Avni and Ms. Natasha Farney, otherwise known as the Ecstasis Duo, have partnered with the Opera House to have their students perform afternoon recitals, dubbed Ecstasis 2.0. Student performers will be coming to the Opera House to give recitals. It's a chance for them to perform, and an opportunity for those of us of a certain age to enjoy an informal matinee concert. I spoke with Eliran and Natasha as they were on the road in Ohio preparing for a concert. Eliran Avni, Natasha Farney, the Ecstasis Duo, welcome back to the podcast. Glad to have you both.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, great. Now, I see that you're having something called Ecstasis 2.0 at the Fredonia Opera House coming up on March 11th, and it's an afternoon of concerts. So can you give us a little background about how this came about and what's going to happen?
So the story starts in 2018, where Tasha and I were talking about the fact, or lamenting the fact, that our students need more performance opportunities. And so we started reaching out to places in the area, like Fellowship of the Spirits in Casadega, and then later the Patterson Library in Westfield, and offered them this idea that the students will come and play concerts basically for free, you know, suggested donation of $5 to $10. Just to cover the cost of the piano tuning. And here we are, what is it, like 5 years later? And we're going to do one in the Opera House, or two, actually.
Two? More than just the one on March 11?
Yeah, there's one coming up also on April 1st. And they have different starting times, actually. March 11th is 1 noon. O'clock.
Sorry, 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock, and yes. April 1st is at noon.
At noon. Okay. That's great. I think these afternoon things are really kind of very nice. How did you decide like doing them in the afternoon at 1 o'clock as opposed to, you know, ones earlier, like 7 o'clock or something like that in the evening?
Well, we're hoping that the afternoon times might work for people who are retired and have some time in the middle of the day. Also, it's a great time for students if they have a break in the middle of their day. But we're really excited about them playing here in Fredonia because they can walk.
Yeah, yes, that's very good. And I sympathize you on the need for more performance spaces for students. I think that I struggled with that a little bit even when I was teaching in the theater department, trying to find alternative spaces for students to have a chance to perform and give everybody that kind of opportunity. So do you have any idea of the repertoire that's coming up, what some of the students are going to be playing?
We're still working on it. It looks like the first one will be mainly piano students, some works by Nikolai Metner, some Beethoven, some Liszt, I believe, some Schumann, Chris Lariana. So really exciting repertoire. And then in the second one, we're going to try and have some more chamber music groups. And I know already that one of our groups that is playing a Mendelssohn piece for two clarinets and a string quartet. It's very exciting, very Midsummer Night Dream, fairies torching the place, kind of piece. It's very exciting. They're going to be probably opening the program on the second concert on April 1st. But in either case, I think what's fun about these is that maybe you don't know the pieces. You're just going to come and enjoy a lovely concert and enjoy the talent of these youngsters who are really fabulous and just need more experience going on stage and performing.
How has the program grown for you, Aileron, since you came here about 5 years ago? How much growth have you seen in the program? Because this I think is a pretty interesting moment of growth for you to extend this way.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I didn't even know that the Opera House existed, so it's more of an inner kind of growth. Rick is in the family, but we played a recital there. We did the first podcast with you. In the Opera House, and I was so impressed with the beauty of the space and the beauty and the feeling of playing in such a lovely, lovely space that it immediately occurred to me, oh, this would be fabulous for the students to play in.
So, Natasha, any of your students going to be playing in the chamber version on April 1st?
Yeah, actually, some of them will be playing solo Bach. I also have a student who is partnered with a guitarist, and they'll be playing a new work by a student written at Fredonia. So that'll be a really fascinating combination. I may also have some other works, but that's to be determined.
Okay. Well, that's all fair. I know that both of these events are going to be very good. And like you said, retired people like me can come in the afternoon. That's actually quite a nice idea. I really think that's wonderful. I have this image of, refreshments and tea tables and.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, I mean, if there wasn't a pandemic going on, you would have muffins and coffee as part of this experience. But we're taking one step at a time.
I'm just glad to know that the music is going to be there. As far as I'm concerned, that's really the highlight. Now, Aileron, you're also the director of the Robert Jordan Piano Festival coming up too. And that's by the time this podcast first makes it, the episode gets released, that will be that coming weekend. I think the weekend of March 4th, starting around March 4th. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I was really bored. I had nothing to do, and I figured, let's do a piano festival. No, we're really very grateful to the Robert Jordan Piano Foundation that is allowing us to do it. And the goal was to offer our students maybe opportunities or events that are not currently included in the curriculum. And we're going to have three incredible recitalists come to campus: Terrence Wilson, Logan Skelton, Sten de Kock will present recitals on each one of the evenings, 4th, 5th, and 6th of March. And we'll also do master classes for our students. All of these events are free, and the audience, everybody's welcome to come and join us at Mason Hall. And in addition, we're going to have Maxine Davis, who is a world-renowned Feldenkrais expert, come and give two free workshops, one on Monday and one on Wednesday, the 28th of February, I believe, and then the 2nd of March from 7 to 9. And of course, all of these details are available online, so you just have to search for the Robert Jordan Piano Festival. And we're also going to have three workshops with Dr. Christian Bernhardt, who is actually faculty at Fredonia, talking about stress management. Noah Kagayama of Bulletproof Musician, He's currently the faculty at Juilliard School working with students. And I'm partial because I did this interview, but I pre-recorded an interview with Dr. Elaine Aaron, world-renowned author of Highly Sensitive Person. The book sold millions of copies, best New York Times seller. And it's a lovely conversation about what it's like to be a highly sensitive person and an artist. And all of those events are free. So all you have to do is just click on the link and join us and really bask in the wonderful talent of these people.
Well, I think, you know, the theme, as I understand it, is like a self-care for the musician, self-care for the artist. Am I correct about that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So the workshops are, and then of course the master classes will, I'm sure, cover technique and style and all these wonderful things as well.
Great. I can't let you two go without asking what's in store for the both of you in the next upcoming few months as the Ecstasis duo. Where are you going? Where are you playing?
Well, we're currently on the road. Actually, we're in Ohio. We have a concert tomorrow at a place called the Holland Theater.
Yeah.
It's in a town called Belle Fountain, and it's a huge theater with a really beautiful acoustic, and we're looking forward to sharing our program from the shadows. And we have another concert next month of the same program in Maryland, and then we have a premiere. You want to talk about that?
Sure. We asked my dear friend and colleague and incredible composer Avner Dorman to write a concerto for the two of us.
Oh, nice.
So we got the parts and we've been crying ever since. They're so hard and so wonderful. So I guess tears of joy more than. And so we're working on that and we're going to perform it in Fredonia on October 15th of next year. So we'll probably be back to discuss that. It's an incredible piece. A lot of Middle Eastern influences, crazy rhythms, sevens and fives, and beautiful, beautiful parts for both of us. So we're very excited.
I already have an earworm singing the melody.
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! Yes. Well, when we get closer to that time, we'll certainly get you back on. Yeah. I mean, so far, you guys are two of my favorite people to interview. So.
Well, we were the first, so that's right,
and you'll always will be the first. So I'm glad to know that you're on the road with From the Shadows and letting people, get a taste of your talent out there down there in Ohio. And I know you're a little pressed for time, so I'll let you go. We got the information we needed, and I think people are going to really enjoy that March 11th presentation for the recitals, and then the April 1st one following that. These are new innovations for the Opera House, and I think they should be. A new and exciting addition to what the programming is over there. So thanks for giving me a little bit of your time, you guys, and have a good time in Ohio. Don't get caught in the snow. Be careful out there.
Thank you.
Thanks Bye-bye.
For talking with us.
Okay. The first of these Ecstasis 2.0 concerts will take place on Friday, March 11th at 1 p.m. Admission is free, but $10 donations to offset costs would be greatly appreciated. Everyone can use a little more coloratura in their lives. And the Live at the Met series also comes roaring back in March with two presentations. The first is Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos, and the second is Giuseppe Verdi's masterpiece Don Carlos. Earlier in January, I spoke with distinguished teaching professor Ms. Julie Newell about these two operas, so I thought I'd take the sections of that interview discussing these operas and give them a replay. Here's what Julie had to say about these two operatic masterpieces. We get an opera that I'm not really all that familiar with and which I find very... I'd like to direct this someday, but Andriani auf Naxos, it seems to be two things in one.
At least two.
What's going on here, Julie?
Yes. Okay. I'm gonna preface this and brag ever so slightly that I had the privilege of singing in a production of Ariadne auf Naxos out in Long Beach, California, a long time ago, in what was the original version of the work. So the Met's advertising it as an opera within an opera. That's what you usually say about Ariadne. Mm-hmm. But its genesis was back in 1912 when Strauss was asked to create 30 minutes, catch this, 30 minutes of opera to conclude Molière's play, a full performance of Molière's play.
Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, yeah.
So the whole play, and then the whole play ends with this 30-minute opera. Well, as these things go, as you well know, it morphed into 90 minutes.
Oh, my.
So the first time it was presented, they presented it in its entirety. So all of Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, all of this 90-minute opera, and it ended up being like a five-hour day-night, mm-hmm. and it wasn't... You know, they premiered at multiple places, but it was not audience friendly in that way. And one of the funniest things, this funniest statements when I was reminding myself of it is that they just couldn't see how opera singers and actors could, you know, really be in the same work. And that totally, it totally cracked me up. I was like, okay, well, there you go. So, that's its original form. And what happened is that Strauss wrote incidental music to insert into Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. Mm-hmm. They regrouped, and in 1916, what was suggested is that Strauss take all of Bourgeois Gentilhomme and condense it into what's called a prologue. So it really changes the weight of who's important in the story. But what they were trying to do right from the beginning is to show the challenges of producing and tragedy versus comedy. And what does the audience really want to see with the idea that, yes, let's put on this great Greek tragedy, Ariadne auf Naxos, but nobody's going to want to come. So we need to put some Commedia dell'arte characters in there to make sure people laugh and sell some popcorn in the lobby. So if we sell some popcorn in the lobby and have some comedic characters, they'll stay for the Greek tragedy. That's my contemporary way of sort of saying what the statement that they're trying to make here. But what happened is then Strauss magically blended these two storylines together. The Ariadne part of it, the Ariadne auf Naxos part of it, is actually, I believe, the Ariadne, yes, is sung by Lisa Davidson, who's amazing. And Bacchus is a guy named Brandon Jovanovich. Their voices are extraordinary, and you will think that you're listening to Wagner because Strauss is an ongoing late romantic extension of Wagner, the size of the voices, the extension of the melodies, the kind of idea that there's not a set aria in the same way that's identifiable to the audience as there is in Rigoletto. But the real vocal star for the audience ends up being Zerbinetta of the mm-hmm. Commedia dell'arte. So Strauss composed this in many ways perfectly to identify the audience's attraction to a character. And it's a rafter blowing kind of coloratura aria with high Fs all around. I mean, it's pièce de résistance. It's something that coloratura is aim to try to perform sometime in their career. But it's a very complex work. And you really should see this MedHD, because you need a major company to bring a work like this to life and have it be everything that Strauss intended it to be.
Well, you know, but speaking of, you know, gigantic operas, we moved to Don Carlos, Giuseppe Verdi's, and, you know, this is a heavy hitter.
It's Verdi's longest opera, coming in at just under 5 hours, I think the production is, you said, Tom.
I believe it was four and a half,
but I think there's is pushing to 4:45, which makes total sense. Magnificent production. I have a statement that I'll say with my students a lot, which is, do your homework before you go to see this. Mm-hmm. And people perceive going to the theater, not just opera, but maybe opera in a more pointed way, differently. Sometimes people want to go the first time and just to experience it and be hit with it, if you will, and take away from it what they do. I think that is a great way to go in many cases, but I'm not sure Don Carlo is the one that you want to just go, because there's so much information about its historic connections. There's so many, I'll call them secondary characters, but they're not really, that are vital to this spider web of destruction of individuals' lives that are part of this. It's based on history. I mean, that's what's interesting. It's historically based, but of course in an Italian operatic romantic way with a lot of extensions to that. But the premise is that Don Carlo, who is Flemish, and who are being, it's during the time of the Inquisition, is in love with Elizabeth de Valois, and he's going to go to Fontainebleau, and is in love with her, wants to marry her, as was the time terribly for so long. She is promised to marriage to King Philip of Spain, the second of Spain. The Flemish and the Spaniards are enemies, so you add to the love conflict, a political conflict, and it's an interesting connection back to the Rigoletto, in the sense of how the people around those in power manipulate the information that they learn, who they tell this secret to or that secret to, who falsifies information, so that the two primary figures actually don't receive accurate information to make their own best decision. And Elizabeth is unable to make her own best decision because of the times and how she's utilized as a pawn. The most famous music in this is the famous duet between Carlo and Rodrigo. Rodrigo is his friend. He's also Flemish. And he tells Rodrigo of his love for Elizabeth, and it turns in, it's one of the all-time great operatic tunes, if you will, where they pledge their friendship and, you know, vow to protect the interests of their country.
And it's sung in French with English subtitles again. And am I correct I believe that the Met's music director is going to be the conductor as well, Yannick Nezet-Séguin?
He is French, and it was originally written in French, hence the length, because the time in which it was written also include a famous ballet, as was necessitated in the French style of the time. Almost simultaneously, it was also written in Italian, so it could be performed in Italy, but they're going back to the original French, which is the more extensive version.
The voices, I imagine, are
well, I'm a huge terrific fan. I'll just give away my secret. So I'm in love with Matthew Polanzani, who's singing Carlo. If for people who listen to the Met a lot, Matthew Polanzani is he's you'll hear him in many, many productions. I won't take the time now to list them all, but it's an absolutely extraordinary voice. He's a marvelous actor. And in this one, I think because of the importance of the duet, which is a real staple of people are learning their operatic music staples, the Rodrigo is a French singer, Etienne Dupuis. And so what I love is this inclusion of, again, French native speakers, French educational heritage as you're creating a work from its original French style.
Don't miss your chance to catch these two superb high-definition performances from the Live at the Met series. Ariadne auf Naxos will be presented on Saturday, March 12th at 1 p.m. Don Carlos will screen on Saturday, March 26th at 12 p.m. Tickets for both events are available at the box office at 716-679-1891. Here's what else is going on in the region for the next 2 weeks. The Fredonia Opera House will host the SUNY Fredonia Student Opera Theater Association's annual Opera Scenes presentation for 2022. The excerpts from works by Donizetti, Bernstein, and Verdi will be presented Thursday, March 3rd, and Friday, March 4th at 7 p.m., and again on Saturday, March 5th at 2 p.m. The Department of Theater and Dance presents the second weekend of Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, Thursday through Saturday, March 3rd through 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Bartlett Theater at the Rockefeller Arts Center. The Fredonia Concert Band will perform in King Concert Hall at the Rockefeller Arts Center on Friday, March 4th at 8 p.m. Also, the Fredonia College Symphony will present an All-America concert under the direction of Dr. David Rudge, along with guest artists Andrew Wolfking and Nick Weiser, on Saturday, March 5th at 8 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Finally, the Marion Art Gallery continues its exhibit entitled New Shapes from Old Tropes, a curated collection of works from Buffalo artists, through April 10th. Tickets for events at the Opera House can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. Tickets for all campus events can also be purchased online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. If you'd like your arts event mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Please allow 4 weeks advance notice for a timely mention. If anything truly defines the month of March, it's the celebration of St. Patrick's Day and all things Celtic. As part of the Folk and Fredonia series, the Opera House is getting into the Irish spirit with a live concert of Irish and Scottish traditional music presented by the premier Celtic music performers in the county, Sue Tillotson and Jim Cunningham. Recently, they've adopted the name Waterhorse, a mythical denizen of Scottish lochs, for their duo. Joining them on March 18th for their concert will be the Bonnie Loch Fiddlers, an ensemble of Sue's violin students. As a fan of Celtic music, and what person named Loch Linn wouldn't be? It was great getting a chance to speak with them about the music they'll be playing. Sue Tillotson, James Cunningham, thank you for joining me to talk about your upcoming performance at the Opera House. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the first thing I'm going to start with to give the listeners a little bit of a clue is sort of you guys have been around for a while and you've been performing for some time, about 10 years or so. But how did the both of you sort of meet and decide that you wanted to play music together?
Well, you know, I guess I made the first contact. Sue's been doing music around Chautauqua County, very well known as a teacher and performer. I went to a performance at JCC of the Bonnie Locke Fiddlers, and I went to see that, and I was surprised to see that type of music. I thought I was the only closet Celt in the area. And I contacted Sue, and then it just went on from there. But the Bonnie Locke Fiddles were my introduction to anybody else around Chautauqua County that played this type of music.
And so then the two of you, Sue, Jim made contact with you. You decided you'd make a good performing duo with because you both play multiple instruments.
Well, that was down the road. At the time, I was just embarking on a stint, about a 10-year stint with an Irish band out of Erie. So I wasn't really open or available to really have anything else at the time. But Jim came on board after a while. He came on board playing with the Fiddlers as our guitarist and has been for a really long time. And so then once the big band sort of disbanded, we got together because we both had a sense that we would rather play sort of serious Celtic music as opposed to pub bar songs, you know, which a lot of people really like, but we wanted to get a little bit more serious and be able to explore all the different instruments that we like. And the different, and he, Jim came from a much more Irish background as far as what music he really resonated to. And I am much more Scottish. So when we first got together, we were like, oh, you got to listen to this. Oh, you got it. So we really shared and cross-tuned, and we learned all sorts of new types of music that we had not really explored before.
I noticed, so I picked up that you were thinking about the difference between Celtic pub music and serious music. Can you expand on that just a little bit? Because I, you know, when you look at the media, you see a lot of these, you know, very, very highly produced Irish kinds of things, Celtic sounds that are just big and huge and they're very popular. But, you know, you're talking about something that's a little bit more traditional. Can I use that word?
Yeah, I'd say that fits. I think certainly like you know, in America, probably the initial source, the main source of Irish music in this country was the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem, and those are sing along songs. You travel around Ireland, you still hear them everywhere. Somebody pops out with one and everybody knows it. Traditional music is a different beast there than what we're used to around here. But a lot of what had interest me besides that was getting more in the instrumentation, the tunes versus the songs. And a lot of that, it took a while to get out there, but certain bands like, Planxty and all brought that instrumentation out into the popular music, and since then it's certainly evolved. And of course, there's well-known bands like U2 and Clanad and that bring that all out. And that's I guess now music's all over the world, and it's not as unique as it was, but you had to just sort of accidentally trip across that and hear this artist and get interest, then search out that one and search out that one until you had source of it. But you know, around here, you don't get that much instrumentation unless you go looking for it.
Right. Sue, you are the one, you play the fiddle, you teach Suzuki violin, you have the Bonnie Locke Fiddlers. I was thinking about this question as I was trying to prepare for the interview, and I was wondering if there's a difference in sound between Celtic fiddling, Scottish fiddling. Is there really that much of a difference? Can you hear it? Is there a distinction one can make?
Oh my God, most definitely. Most definitely. All kinds of folk fiddle are really closely connected to the language they come from. And even in Scotland, there are four regions, the Highlands, the Lowlands, and they all have a different brogue, and their fiddle is different. And it's, you know, the Northeast is very, have lots of trills in their speech. So does the fiddle. And the Irish sound is totally different than the Scottish sound. And within Ireland, all the different counties are different, can be recognized. So it's kind of a ethnomusicologist's dream, you know, to sort of look into that and find the connections. There's definitely a language. So when I teach my classical students, they learn how to speak classical. When they start to play Scottish, they learn how to speak Scottish, and they are bilingual in music. You know, they sometimes it invades the other, but it's just like teaching someone English and French. You know, it's just really a great thing, and it opens up a whole world of experiences they would never have had.
It's interesting. Speaking of English and French, because the music that I like to listen to, actually, I enjoy Cape Breton music from Nova Scotia. I think that stuff is really, really pretty good. And I don't know where your music falls in terms of that particular language.
Well, that's Scottish. That's considered a branch, of course, because that's where they, during the clearances, they tended to land there. And it was rather isolated for a long time. There are some who say that might be the true Scottish sound. There's a lot of differences in that. There are also the French influences, the French Canadian influences as well that you can hear. But yeah, we incorporate, I believe, everyone, if you play Scottish, you're definitely going to play some Cape Breton as well.
Yeah. Jim, you play a number of string instruments. And interestingly enough, you play the bouzouki, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, the Irish bouzouki in particular.
Is there a difference between that and the Greek bouzouki?
It all started with a Greek bouzouki being brought over to Ireland. And I think it was Johnny Moynihan was the first one that got credit for it. And he started playing it. And then it lent itself so well to the music that it just sort of took off. As far as I could tell, like the main difference, besides structurally, the way they're built, the Greek bouzouki generally has six strings to it, which is, you know, they're in courses, like pairs of strings. So they'd be like three pair.
Mm-hmm.
Although they do have some instruments as well that have the eight strings, four courses to them.
Mm-hmm.
The Irish bouzouki typically is eight strings, four courses to it. Of course, there's all sorts of different ways to tune it. And if you're going to be looking at luthiers' websites, you'll find all sorts of breakdowns on, you know, what do you call this instrument? What's the difference between this one and this one? It's like, well, it depends. I think whoever cashes the check, they can call it whatever they want when they're making something. But the tuning is essentially the same. I think the Greek bouzouki is a little bit longer scale than the Irish bouzouki is. But besides drastically different musical styles, of course. I think in Ireland it's used largely as a backup instrument, quarterly, and in Greek music it does not seem to be the case. But they're all part of the mandolin family of instruments, just like all the different instruments in the fiddle family. You know, you take a picture of one, and then you make the picture bigger. You can say, okay, this is a bass now, and it's a dangerous collection to get into to say I like this one. Well, here's another one; it's a little different. All right, I guess I'll get that one too. the closets overflow with extra instruments that you never get around to playing.
You've also picked up the Celtic harp, I noticed as well, too. Mm. Is that something you picked it up afterwards, or how long have you been playing that instrument?
Well, everything really gets down to starting to play guitar, and then after several years, you just sort of get into that. But it, I guess, it was back around the mid '80s when it was first getting interested in the harp. Actually, I heard a wire harp player at JCC. And prior to that, to me, harp music was the one woman in Lawrence Welk's orchestra that played this giant instrument. I'd never heard an Irish harp, and it was an amazing instrument to me, very bell-like in its quality. And then you just start looking around and try to find out who makes them. And of course, everybody who makes them is either in Ireland or California. There's nothing like that around this. Even now, it's very limited around this part of the country. But I, first thing, I bought a plywood kit, and then later on I made one in the kitchen and somehow managed to hide that from my landlord while I had the bandsaw set up in the kitchen. I bought a couple others since that time. You get one, you pass them along. It's when I'm in the mood for it, it's a lot of fun. It's a very peaceful sort of instrument, and it's the kind of instrument I think that anybody, if they don't play, you get it in somebody's hand, and in no time you could be the way it's tuned, it's very simple to come out with a little kind of a melody. Where, as you know, like with guitar, you have to know something before you can get something out of it that's recognizable. With the harp, it's just sort of the Celtic harp. It's in a diatonic tuning that it's just melodies come out of whatever you play there, so it sort of sucks you into it. But it takes more commitment, and it takes more time to haul it around. And I'm very, very, very as far from proficient as you can be on harp. You know, it's just something that you play with there. But yeah, it's a very, very peaceful sort of an instrument to play. Once you get it tuned, that's not quite so peaceful.
It's a challenge. So tell me, Sue, what do you got planned for the upcoming concert? What's going to be the repertoire?
Well, a lot of the ideas are coming, I think, mostly from Jim, but both of us, because we were very active in the folk in Fredonia, the Free for All event that would happen every year, and that whole community. And that has fallen by the wayside for various reasons. So we're sort of feeling the urge to bring some of that kind of thing back. Some sing-alongs, you know, that we know folks out there will like. We've got the Fiddlers just coming in to play what they do all by themselves. But then for the first time, really, we're having them accompany us on a few things. So actually some songs that we're going to do where the Fiddlers are going to come in and add some melody breaks. So it's rather different than what we usually do in that respect. So I also play the Norwegian fiddle, the Hardanger. It's a Harden Fele. So I don't have a lot of opportunities to play that out. So I will be bringing that to play just a few things, a little sampler of that. So anything to add, Jim?
I think playing at the Opera House with, besides the setting, with the audience that you have, just opens it up to doing things that you might not do at another venue. You've got a very receptive and eclectic audience up for anything. So you can present things that you wouldn't necessarily do if you're doing a gig at a venue. It's like, well, what do you want? Okay, we'll check that off on the list. Well, here you can play with more things, and you can expose them to something you wouldn't use anyplace else. And they're glad to hear it. It's an artistic environment. It's an awful lot of friends that we've made over the years that we fully expect to be there at the time. So it's a very, I can't imagine a better venue to play than at the Opera House.
I saw something on your website called Waterhouse. Is that an album or something that you guys have out that's available?
Water Horse.
My apologies. Okay. Water Horse, yes.
Yeah, it is actually our most recent CD. And there's a tune that we play on the CD called Water Horse, which the legend is about some myth, in Scotland about what might inhabit the waters over there. And we thought it would be lovely to actually have that as our band name. So we're sort of wiggling with that a little bit and having that as the website, and because it's just a really cool name. We just really like it.
Well, and it is a cool name. So let me verify that for you. It's definitely a cool name. And the graphic is outstanding. I love the graphic, the Celtic knot interwoven with the horse. I wish I could show it to people. So they'll just have to come down to the Opera House so you can bring the CD and let people see the graphic, because that's pretty interesting. So
thank you, because we're really happy with it.
Yeah, you should be. Water Horse is really a kind of a nice way to market yourself, particularly with the music that's on that album. I think I heard a couple of cuts. Jim, when I listened to your first sing, Jim, the first name that came to mind, actually, the timbre of your voice was Stan Rogers, the very famous Canadian folk singer. Has anybody ever told you that?
I don't know if anybody's ever said that. Yeah, it's thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm a major Stan Rogers fan, and every now and then I'll cycle around to where that's all I play. It was such a loss to music and to Canada when he passed away there. He was, and even now he's still, I'd imagine you mentioned his name up in Canada, and yeah, he's got to be, so well known for what he put out in there. I do a little bit of Stan Rogers material. It's usually a lot of the trick is to try to figure out how exactly he played the guitar on that particular song. He comes up with certain Gaelic tunings and stuff, but I'm getting there a little bit. Well, thanks again.
Now, you're welcome. We have something in common. We're both big Stan Rogers fans. Well, listen, you two, thank you very much for the time. I really do appreciate it. Sue, the Bonnie Locke players, the fiddlers are probably going to be something we'll enjoy, and that's your gig. So thanks very much for that. I appreciate your time. Jim, you two as well. It should be an interesting evening of music. Now, it comes I think March 18th, the day after St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, so we'll still get people maybe to wear a little green one day. Doesn't matter, right?
Well, I guess the way I'm looking at it is that it's not a late St. Patty's Day gig. It's an incredibly early St. Patty's Day gig.
All right. We'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. I look forward to meeting you both. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Water Horse, featuring Sue Tillotson and Jim Cunningham, along with the Bonnie Loch Fiddlers, will be performing at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, March 18th, 2022, at 7:30 p.m. As always, tickets are available from the box office at 716-679-1891. Finally, if you really want a spring event to look forward to, look no further than the 5th Annual 1891 Run for the Fredonia Opera House, which will take place on Sunday, April 24th, 2022, beginning at 9 a.m. The run, or walk if you prefer, is a 5K distance on mostly flat ground through the village of Fredonia and the SUNY Fredonia campus. This year's event will be completely live. There is no virtual option, as in the past 2 years. Registration is now open by going to www.fredopera.org and following the links for the 1891 run, or using the link in the description of this podcast on its Podbean site at aisleseat.podbean.com. This is a major fundraiser for the Fredonia Opera House, and it helps to support all the many programs and event series presented by the Opera House. If you can't make the run, please consider making a donation by following the links to the registration website and making your donation there. And that's it for this In Like a Lion edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Eliran Avni, Natasha Farney, Julie Newell, Sue Tillotson, and Jim Cunningham for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email us at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. We'll return in 2 weeks on March 16th, 2022. I'm Tom Lachlan, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.